Rulings just out from the Supreme Court show that the justices are finding interesting ways to assemble major majorities among themselves on some key issues. And Bulletin, working class voters in New York City have badly disappointed socialists everywhere in their mayoral vote yesterday. And speaking of voting, the Democratic Party's big voting reform bill just died. And now suddenly leading Democrats say they don't oppose voter ID after all. And there's so much more to talk about on today's edition of The Independent Outlook. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute here in Oakland, California. We're right across the bay from San Francisco, and we're going to try and bring you some independent perspectives on the issues of the day. And of course, at the beginning here, I want to thank our friends at thinkspot.com for making this possible, and also welcome everybody who's coming to us to view this also via YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth. And of course, keep in mind, those of you using the ThinkSpot platform, you can submit questions and comments, which will quickly make their way to me, and we can try and address them. So let me begin by also welcoming and recognizing my friends and colleagues. First of all, David Thoreau, president and founder of the Independent Institute. Hi, David.
Hi.
Nice to see you. Nice tie you got on today.
Thank you.
Hey,
nice,
you've got some,
same to you.
Thank you. You've got some nice books on the shelf behind you. Looks like Independent Institute has been busy publishing.
We have been busy. Absolutely.
Yeah. Everyone should take stock of our latest books.
Here's one of our latest.
I love that one. Yeah. Tell them quickly.
It's called Really Good Schools by James Tooley. It's from his work globally on low-cost private schools, high-quality private schools for the poor, and bringing that message and opportunity to America.
Good book. Let me also welcome Williamson Evers, my colleague who is the director of our Center on Educational Excellence. Hello, Bill Evers.
How are you?
Great to see you. Every time we have another edition of this broadcast, your bookcase behind you gets fuller and fuller.
It's an excellent bookcase, but it's not just the case, it's the books.
Yeah, let's take some bets on what percent of those he's actually read. With him, it's probably a pretty high percentage.
It's all of them.
Probably all of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk. First of all, let me just point out that late breaking news as of today, the Supreme Court, which is allegedly deeply divided amongst the justices, keeps coming up, as it did today, with some remarkably large majorities, in some cases unanimous rulings. Seems like the principle is where they can get themselves together. When a case seems to be about individual liberty or privacy, they can muster strong majorities amongst themselves, cross the so-called partisan divide, or sometimes unanimous ones, like today. This is the case where the Supreme Court said that the school district in Pennsylvania was wrong to pull the young lady off of the cheerleading squad from her public school. She was 14 years old at the time, and she was upset at not making the squad, or something went wrong. And she went on a social media rant saying, F this, F that, F everything. And the school decided that they were gonna do something about that. And so it turns out they can't. 8-1 decision, her speech was protected. Pretty interesting. What do you make of that, either of you?
Well, you know, it's off campus, but the problem that the school sees is that with electronic media, something that you do off campus is available on campus.
Right.
So it's sort of a new world, but I think it has to still be that the school has jurisdiction over its own things that happen in its own boundaries or on like a school trip or something like that.
But not outside.
Right. And so I think that it's a reasonable decision, even though I deplore the language of the young woman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wish she hadn't said that. But, you know, I do find it heartening, honestly, that the Supreme Court is willing to give speech a pretty high protection. And it needs it, especially in this era.
Well, another one of their unanimous decisions I have to really disagree with, and that was the one on college athletes and paying college athletes and antitrust law. So
okay.
My first.
I mean, it sounded like, though, that it was a vindication of the little guy, the powerless athlete against the big, powerful universities and NCAA.
I'm always skeptical about antitrust. You know, it's the government uses it, rival companies use it to tamp down their competition. and it's too easy to make a case. So if you're charging more than the other guy, well, that's price gouging. And if you're charging less than the other guy, well, that's predatory price cutting. And if you're charging the same as the other guy, that's collusion. So
oh, no.
There's nothing a company can do that's not subject to this political interference by the government. Now, in the case of these sports things, this goes back to earliest days of collegiate sports. And naturally, universities and colleges didn't want to have to pay their athletes. They could get away without doing it, right? I mean, it stands to reason it added to their costs. But it figured in another important way because, you know, there are people that could set up rival leagues and all sorts of things. There were ways that you could undercut a collusive agreement among colleges not to pay athletes. But it began to be tied into accreditation. So if you weren't living up to the rules of the NCAA, then you could lose your accreditation.
And which in turn means you would lose all your millions of tax dollars.
Right, right. Or foundation money too. I mean, it's just, so the thing is you couldn't make enough money if you had really, like, think of professional football, all right? So they have really great athletes, right? So you couldn't really make enough money to pay for the entirety of the university. So they wanted these subsidies. They wanted this philanthropy. And so that's why they've tried to do it. I personally think they should be able to do it. It's just like any other thing that goes on a college campus. The college campus, the college authorities should be able to do it. It's not that, like, they're kidnapping people and forcing them into slavery or something like that. These are young people who want to engage in sports and they want to go to college at the same time. And I think it's wrong for the government to be interfering. And I think we're about to see an immense tide of antitrust activism. The Biden administration is putting a woman, Lina Khan, in as the head of the Federal Trade Commission. And instead of antitrust or anti-monopoly efforts cracking down on government privileges of monopoly, she just wants, if you're a big and successful company, well, that's evil. So I think we're about to see a real circus of disregard for the consumer welfare and just allowing rivals to go after companies that have been more successful at putting out a good product and making consumers happy.
That is kind of worrisome. On the sports case in particular, David Thoreau, do you think that there's something to be said, though, for something to be said in spite of the Supreme Court for the colleges who want to somehow be guardians of the ideal of amateurism?
Yes, I do. But I think one of Bill's points, I would suggest, is the key point, which is we've talked about this in previous episodes of Independent Outlook, that cartels cannot endure without government or some entity policing the cartel, keeping people in line. Mm-hmm. And that can include subsidies and regulation and other ways to police it. The NCAA is heavily subsidized. It's heavily subsidized because it draws on heavily subsidized institutions of higher education.
Exactly, exactly.
We did a study a number of years ago comparing the funding of private versus public universities. We found out that if you consider tuition to be private, the average private university receives more funding than the public universities.
That's just what
so
I was thinking.
Essentially, what you have is an organization that is a cartel of different school development departments and athletic departments. And it's not just the funding they get, the school gets directly, it's also indirectly, because the recruiting, the training, and so forth of these college athletes starts in K through 12, which is 95% funded by taxpayers.
David is
then
making
you, then
excellent
you add in
points.
The fact that virtually all the stadium and facilities are government facilities. Mm-hmm. And then you take it to professional sports, and it's even worse. You see that this is really a government-enabled cartel. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do you approach it?
You could even claim it's a very indirectly set up bread and circuses. You could.
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
Yeah.
So, I think Bill is, you know, hit on the point, which is, and we've talked about this with other examples of power, economic power, whatever, is to withdraw the subsidies and the special privileges that these entities have.
Mm-hmm. So then let's see if they can make an agreement. You know,
right. We'll see. You can start out with the Sherman Antitrust Act, and if you read the first two portions of it, it doesn't say what the government should be doing. It simply points out that these cartels, however they may endure, are anti-competitive. So you could actually use that part of the Sherman Act to talk about eliminating government privileges that police the cartels. I mean, the classic example, of course, was
aviation.
Well, aviation and the telephone system.
Mm-hmm. And trucking.
And trucking, absolutely. So trucking was deregulated. The Interstate Commerce Commission was the facilitator of that, and also state agencies too. But in the case of the Bell system, that was broken up into the so-called baby bells. You could make a very good case that the regulations should have been eliminated, but they weren't initially. And it turned out that when the baby bells were created, technology caught up and essentially made the baby bells obsolete.
Right.
And that simply brought down the whole system. So
I think we have better, I mean, we, the three of us all grew up in a time when the Bell monopoly existed.
I remember.
And I think we'd have to say, we don't really want to say the telephone system anymore. We want to say telecommunications.
Yes, right.
It's much better now. And it's not obvious that it would be as advanced. I think it's the opposite. It's obvious that it wouldn't be as advanced as it is today if that monopoly were still in
place. I just want to point out that I barely remember the Bell system.
Oh, you are such a...
I mean, literally, if those who don't know, the phone company actually owned your phone.
That's right.
And
it was a big innovation when they allowed the pink princess phone to come.
That's right. You could own your own phone.
My mother loved that one.
Right. And so I think with the NCAA, and I think Bill's right. I think that this is a new trend. But if we want to be honest about it, breaking up concentrations, getting back to Adam Smith, the way to do it is to eliminate these monopoly powers that the government facilitates to keep
and
the cartels in operation.
Some of them will naturally break up because they're artificial mergers that wouldn't be supportable on the market.
That's right, exactly. And so there are many studies now on this whole issue of industrial organization and the size of the firm and the nature of the firm and so on. A firm is simply an organization of people who are internalizing costs and operating in a cooperative manner to achieve a common goal. And it's not a scientific thing. It involves science, but it's an art form. And it's a constantly fluid process that you're adapting to new conditions with new people. And you exist only to the extent you're satisfying consumers that want to purchase your good or service. So if the government sets up a system that favors some firms over others, or essentially outlaws firms to be competitors, that's where the problem creeps in.
Speaking of people cooperating together for a common purpose, and speaking of the government outlawing people, one of the other things the Supreme Court looked at was a case of Catholic Social Services. And what had happened was that in Philadelphia, they had a very overbroad, vague thing that seemed to mean that the government could kind of arbitrarily deny all sorts of people, capacity to work as foster care suppliers and things like that. And the court didn't, the only thing they agreed on, and it was again overwhelming, was that the law was too vague. They didn't really get to the free exercise case. So, you know, the real question is, if you have some set of beliefs that say in social policy arena and the government disagrees, can they use that disagreement to tamper with your ability to operate?
Shut you out.
Yeah, shut you out. And they didn't really get to that. So that's that case is called Smith, the one that gives them the capacity to interfere, and the justices went with the lowest common denominator, and they didn't reach this. But, you know,
but apparently,
one of them wrote, this decision is so unimportant that it might as well be written on paper in vanishing ink, that disappeared.
Well, but that's how they got their unanimity.
Right, but they still need to struggle. Look, there are constitutional issues here, and they do need to think them through.
And I see the fingerprints of Chief Justice Roberts on this one yet again, who
right,
always...
But I think Gorsuch pretty much showed where Roberts was, right. As you put it, it's lawyerly trickery is what the term is.
Lawyerly trickery, yeah.
I do want to slightly defend this thing of not... We wouldn't probably like the Supreme Court if they went as far as they could in every case. You see, so that's why they.
Well, no one wants them to go as far as they. I don't want them to go as far as they can. I want them to uphold the law, whatever
right.
that
but
requires.
But they need to have a ripe case that.
Yes, they do.
Brings out the issues in a clear way, and I guess there wasn't.
But apparently,
in this that a majority could find the answer on this.
Apparently,
but anyway, we do need to revisit this, and the topic is of central importance.
It's going to come back. I mean, apparently, though, in the wake of this ruling, at least Catholic Social Services of Philadelphia will be able to set own policy for how they place out adoptive children under what conditions.
Until Philadelphia writes a new rule, right?
That's
a little more carefully constructed. So speaking of various cities, and the big city in the news was the New York City election.
Skip to that, Bill, I want to mention one other thing.
The
Supreme Court also just ruled on Cedar Point Nursery versus Hassid, which is a ruling that basically said that property owners can exclude people who they don't want on their property. And this was a very important ruling, and I have to...
So this is a labor organizing thing.
Yeah, I commend the Pacific Legal Foundation for handling this case.
Well done, friends.
And it's actually quite... It's not limited to union activists. It's really, you know, it's...
The general principle.
Right, people living along the border of Texas have a right to exclude people who come across the line if they enter their property. And if private property means anything, it means who you allow to immigrate onto it, including union activists or anybody.
Anyway, we had a big election in New York City. And as Graham said at the outset, it was disappointing to the left in the United States. The left had thought with the election of Bill de Blasio that they were on a tear in New York City and it was going to be a utopian model for the rest of the United States. Now, of course, his term as mayor has been a catastrophe. Crime everywhere, schools showing very low performance, lots of divisiveness, racial and ethnic strife. I could easily go on. One of the most funny things is huge subsidies to a charity, a non-performing charity run by his wife. But anyway, that aside, they had an election. So There are so few Republicans now that unless the Republican is like a movie star, it's very hard to elect a Republican to be mayor. Now, of course, Rudy Giuliani was like a movie star, and Michael Bloomberg is one of the richest people in the country. So they were able to get elected as Republicans, but it's pretty darn hard. So the Democratic primary amounts to the election.
Right.
And they're not, because they have this elaborate voting system where you can rank your choices, they're not, it's not fully compiled yet. But Adams, who's a borough president, but also a former policeman, is 10 points in the lead, which is probably a commanding lead.
It's a pretty commanding lead. It's pretty hard to see.
And it's
stunning when you look at the geographical distribution of the vote tallies, because in Bronx, which is the poorest and the least white and the least educated, by socialist logic, it ought to be voting left, but actually he won 46% of the first batch in the Bronx, and his closest contender, Maya Wiley, who campaigned on defunding the police, she got 17% in the Bronx.
It was clear from the polling, by the way, that the overwhelming interest of the electorate was in establishing law and order, mm-hmm. and pushing back against crime and lowering the amount of crime. Overwhelming. And this Maya Wiley was one of the left candidates. And in my own field of education, she sort of stands out because she spent all her time attacking academic screens. So some schools in New York City, public schools, have an exam or some other set of standards, hoops you have to leap through in order to go to those schools. So they concentrate, they specialize, they look for talented people and try to give them a leg up in getting prepared for life and for further schooling. And so she was calling these racist. Yes, but what about her own children? Oh, it turns out that they went to such special schools or to elite private schools. So I'm sorry, it's nothing new to find left-wing progressives being mm-hmm. hypocrites, but she certainly was on this one.
So, and I think that this is also an indication of the situation in many blue states and blue cities.
Yes.
People are fed up, and I think that it's just building.
Listen to this. Let me just quote, just a second. I want to quote this fascinating quote from Eric Adams during his sort of initial victory speech.
The leader, right?
Yeah, the leader, the former police officer, the one who was against defunding the police and in favor of making neighborhoods safe again and so forth. Listen to this comment. He says, "How dare those with their philosophical and intellectual theorizing and their classroom mindset talk about the theory of policing? You don't know this. I know this. I'm going to keep my city safe." So what kind of people are the ones sitting around with their philosophical and intellectual theorizing? Not the African-American working class voter in New York. It's the people who voted for Wiley who are in the upper East and West Side, in certain parts of Williamsburg, in the areas where, you know, they're predominantly white, actually, and upper income. You could almost hear an echo in Eric Adams's comments last night of some things that I've read recently by Victor Davis Hanson, which we've reposted on our own site.
Or even a very carefully worded Trump insight.
Because what's going on here is that this is yet another example where it seems that the least affluent minority voters seem to be moving to the right, even while affluent white voters are moving to the left, which is, you know, counterintuitive by classic socialist class analysis.
It's because culture matters.
It's because culture matters. It really does. Yeah. Elaborate on that point, David. I would love to hear you elaborate on that point.
Well, culture matters, and the situation in the family is the bedrock of any society. And a lot of the elites, a lot of the white elite children are going, they're being miseducated at elite schools, which are bought into the progressive narrative.
Particularly in New York, where some of the most
in New York.
Egregious things of videos being shown to young children with full of explicit sexual topics and just stuff that's not really academic, but more satisfying to some adults' desire to, you know, open minds where really these adults' minds should be not open but closed for repairs.
Poor and middle class families don't buy this woke stuff because
they're trying to get their children
trying to have a better life.
They're
trying to indoctrinate them. That's right. One thing I should point out also is the events that I guess it was today in Loudoun County in Virginia.
Loudoun.
Yesterday.
And they had this big school board meeting, and was it 200 or 300 parents showed up? Place was
251 people signed up to speak.
And the board rules no more comments and shuts it down. And then they bring the police in to evict everybody in the auditorium. And the place just breaks into panamania. I mean, it's the same old thing. What they're complaining about was the teaching of critical race theory and transgender theory to children. And the parents are not going to put up with it.
We're
seeing this in
and also forcing this on the teachers too.
On the teachers, absolutely. Yeah. So it culture matters, and I think that progressives who are pushing this are going to have a rude awakening, because the common sense of most people is going to rule out.
And you said there are some interesting electoral implications here in the results from November 2020. I was very struck by the fact that African-American male voters gave Trump a larger portion of their votes, not a majority, but a larger than had for any Republican candidate for a long time. Yes. And, you know, you wonder why is that? It's got to be these factors, because ordinary working class people can see the problem.
And it could also be economic prosperity of blacks under Trump, too. Let's give a little credit to that. But I tend to agree with you that the culture probably had a lot to do with it. Speaking of voting, front page news was that the Democrats attempt to use voting changes to lock in a permanent rule of their party in the United States flopped in the
H.R. 1, S.1.
Yeah. But now people are turning to the so-called Manchin plan, named after Senator Manchin of West Virginia. I think, though, the Wall Street Journal had an excellent editorial on this, and John Fund had an excellent op-ed on this. So John Fund pointed out that the Manchin law allows people to use utility bills. And he said, utility bills are very easy to forge. All you need is a color printer. Mm-hmm. And so that's not a good route. And whoever can block this law as long as it has that in it should do so. And the Wall Street Journal pointed that out again, but it also pointed out that the Manchin plan has a huge disclosure requirement. So if you're even tangentially commenting on things and issues and things that candidates are doing, and forget about saying vote for, but if you're somehow affecting the election, everything has to be reported. And this is a terrible thing for free speech.
That's very worrisome.
There's a drive, of course, by some activists currently on the left, but they could be on the right, to do what's called doxing, where you reveal who people are, where they live, where they work, what their phone numbers are, what their email addresses are. All of this, of course, would be required to be disclosed by this law. And then they get bullied and harassed endlessly. Mm-hmm. We saw this in California beginning 10 years ago. But also, radicals in the 50s and 60s used to say that the NAACP and the Socialist Workers Party and various people said, look, if we have to disclose all this information about our donors, about our members, they're just going to be endlessly harassed, and why can't they have some privacy?
It's what the Supreme Court sometimes calls a chilling effect.
And I think also part of the situation is this recent Monmouth poll that showed that something like 80% of voters are in favor of a photo ID to vote.
Right.
And only, 18% oppose it. And then suddenly,
the Manchin thing would not allow that.
Two of the major
thing would not require photo ID because you know your photo is not on your utility bill.
Here you have Stacey Abrams that called the recent Georgia legislation about having voter ID and so forth Jim Crow 2, just came out saying that she's in favor of voter ID.
Not necessarily picture ID, and that is a key difference.
And Raphael Warnock claims he's always been in favor of voter ID.
No way. Both. He was totally against it.
See, well, they both were. And
they were both saying it was racist.
Yeah, and Abrams is going to be, I think, exposed because it turns out that she made quite a bit of money off the election system through her own private business firm on November 3rd. Plus the fact that there's this growing movement starting in Maricopa County in Arizona to have a full audit.
Like forensic.
Forensic audit that is admissible in court. And all the recounts and other audits that are not full forensic audits are not admissible in court. So this has gotten the attention of a lot of people in other states who visited to see how it was set up.
You need to distinguish between a regular audit, which just means looking at the process, and a forensic audit, which means going in and looking at each ballot and what its characteristics are and where it went and what it looks like and all that sort of thing. So they are, go ahead, David. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I did think that our listeners needed a clarification there.
And so in the Maricopa situation, they have three people for every single ballot examining it. Everything that goes on in this arena where they're counting and checking on the ballots is videotaped from every direction. So there's a complete record of every single thing that happens. So that's why legislators from other states have been coming. We're talking about Georgia and Michigan and Wisconsin and especially Pennsylvania. So I think there's going to be a trend that we can look at.
It was very close in Maricopa County. And the people doing this audit have said, look, this isn't going to change the result of the election. But we can learn if there was skullduggery. We can learn how to guard against it in future elections. And that's a very important thing because, then the people who want to engage in skullduggery will have to try something new and different.
But there's also the issue, Bill, that, that's exactly what the Marconi group and the Arizona Senate ruled on. But there is the bigger question about down ticket tallies as well. And there's enormous precedent for that if the count is checked later and is found that someone else won, that
then
person
will
be replaced. So we don't know what's gonna happen, but I think this is a big first step. And it's certainly in sync with what the public wants and what the evidence seems to be leading us to.
The polling results in favor of voter ID certainly suggest why Raphael Warnock and Stacey Abrams seem to have changed their tune on voter ID. I mean, she said the other day, last week, she said, no one has ever objected to having to prove who you are to vote. It's been part of our nation's history since the inception of voting. Yet no one has objected to it except for herself.
For her objecting.
Well, right. Because
I think there's a certain CYA in her case, because I said, information is coming out about her, the corruption, really, of what she was involved in.
So, but I mean, what she has stood for and others have stood for on that side of the question has been that it should be enough for someone to just step up and say, I am so-and-so, I declare myself so to be, and then they're just accepted.
It's worse than that because it's not a question of someone just stepping up. It's a question of having some sort of paper claiming that person exists.
Right.
It all reminds me of ballot box 13 in Wells County, Texas, during the primary race between Coke Stevenson and Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Okay. Now, this is before my time, but go ahead.
Oh, so Coke Stevenson was kind of a old-fashioned Southern Democrat, and Lyndon Johnson was a down-the-line Franklin Delano Roosevelt New Deal, left side of the New Deal guy in those days. And so he was running against Coke Stevenson in the Democratic primary, and he was going to lose. So there was this county, Wells County, along the Rio Grande, where the boss of the party machine in that area was allied with Johnson. And so he found a box, seriously found a box that had just enough votes in it to push Johnson over.
Yep.
Classic famous case.
Well, now I have a question before we change the subject. I do have a more kind of fundamental or maybe constitutional question about SR1, H1, and so forth. Yeah, they failed. And then Joe Manchin of West Virginia is proposing another one. But regardless, whether it's those original ones that have failed or Joe Manchin's proposal, they all have to do with the federal government, the central government, setting voting
over the voting process, which by the Constitution belongs to the states.
And I don't get, because I was looking at my Constitution, you know, Article 1 and the 17th Amendment both specify that the states determine who's going to be eligible to vote for their own legislative election. That in turn determines who's eligible to vote for these federal offices. And then, of course, in Article 2, it's clear that the state legislatures themselves are specifically granted the power to control who's eligible to, you know, to elect the president of the United States.
A problem in our last election.
Yeah, so I don't understand in either case whether Manchin's supposedly more moderate
His is
replacement.
In violation of it, too.
Yeah, yes. I should think it would be.
The whole thing's in violation. And you know, their hope was that they would end the filibuster and take over the Senate, get Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia states again, expansion, and they would then pack the Supreme Court, and they would simply overrule the Constitution.
That's really scary.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean,
with this Biden juggernaut and all these tax and spend proposals, is we're seeing inflation worries all over the country, including top economists, including various statements coming from officials of the Federal Reserve and former officials of the Federal Reserve. And, you know, they've been printing money in the way that the Fed does by buying bonds and monetizing the debt and so forth. And at some point, it comes to an end with a kind of a crash and a realization that everything is overvalued. So,
and apparently, just as a bullet point there, inflation is apparently up 5% year over year as of this past month, May, the highest level of inflation in 13 years.
Even the people who want a rule-based inflation, low inflation, are not talking about 5%. They're talking about 1% or 2%. You know, if you had a gold standard, you'd have a very slowly going on deflation. So, you know, we can all, the three of us can remember when Cokes were a dime, when gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. It's a different world now.
Yeah.
And so this is a steady process of inflation. It's a tax on the people who have fixed incomes. It has many things. It has even a strong effect in education in my field. In higher education, where things are, you know, more affected by prices and economic policies and so forth. So if you're a college, if you're a private college or a tuition-taking state university or college, you get your tuition and you set your tuition once, right, before the kid comes back for the year or comes for the first year or whatever it is. And that's what the consumer is paying. It might be the parents, might be the kid who's doing it, working job to get paid for it, or whatever it is, you have that. A company that's in business and is faced with inflation, that company has to that company can adjust if inflation is coming on. It's much more agile than a university. So universities are going to be very, very distressed by this. This is all discussed by Richard Vedder, who's the most serious economist who studies higher education in America and is affiliated with Independent Institute, has a number of recent books, but Restoring the Promise is the one that's most relevant for this.
Yes, there it is behind David's shoulder. Actually, Dr. Richard Vedder may be watching this program with us right now. So if so, we're glad for your work, Dr. Vedder.
Also, you know, another thing that's going to happen is that foreign students faced with a disruption that comes with inflation are going to be less prone to come to the United States. A lot of American colleges and universities depend on the income from foreign students who they can charge full prices for. So that's another thing that may come in the face of inflation.
Well, now, of course, we should be reassured because the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, Jerome Powell, just said a couple of days ago that it's very, very unlikely that there'll be a repeat of 1970s style inflation. Which, I mean,
well, we are having stagflation, exactly the symptoms of the 1970s that the Keynesians said could never happen.
And, you know, I was going to ask
people like Judy Sheldon and others know, Austrian school people certainly know that stagflation can happen.
David, I was going to ask you to comment specifically on this. The sense that people don't understand, which I think you get because of your work in economics, is that inflation functions as a kind of regressive tax, and it exacerbates income inequality, does it not?
It does.
How does that work?
Well, the view that Yellen and others in the Biden administration, the sort of conventional Keynesian view, is, here's a quote, "Never before have we seen such coordinated expansionary fiscal and monetary policy. This will continue as output moves above potential. This is why this time is different for inflation."
And always say this time is different.
Always say this.
And that is your key for knowing it's gonna something bad's gonna happen.
Right, and it these are the same people. This is David Fulkers Landau, in the 70s. It was Fed Chairman Paul Volcker who reined in the expansionary powers, and there was a recession that resulted. And when taxes were reduced and so forth, that resulted in a boom, but it was based more on the productivity of the economy and not some artificial stimulus. And the Keynesians believe in a free lunch. And this whole view of so-called modern monetary theory is a pipe dream. But that's what they're putting their hopes on.
We have,
because of this, there's going to have to be another Volcker-type situation.
Yep.
And it's not going to be a pleasant thing to go through, but, you know, things are going to have to find their level that's not an artificial level.
There's one way out, in addition to, you know, the obvious approach is, traditional approach is to monetize the debt, increase taxes, and so on and so forth. But there's another approach to deal with the debt, and that approach is by liquidating federal assets. The federal government owns who knows how many trillions of dollars worth of land and buildings and vehicles and mineral rights and everything else. And we've shown in the past how you could eliminate the entire national debt a number of times over by only just simply liquidating at conservative valued prices. And it may be that is what's going to be needed. Otherwise, the average person is going to be really slammed.
And you know, we have a wonderful new senior fellow, Judy Shelton, who just published quite a piece in the New York Sun. I think we have it on our own website, independent.org. where she looks back and reminds us we've been here before. She recalls a time in the article in the New York Sun. She recalls a time when Janet Yellen, current Treasury Secretary, who had been chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank and a member of the Federal Reserve Board, when Janet Yellen basically made light of inflation and said that it had psychological benefits because people could feel that they were better off even though they were worse off. And this was apparently taken for granted by Janet Yellen and a number of her other Federal Reserve Board members at the time, some 25
years. Thus, by government officials, is never good.
It's really stunning. And they laughed about it, according to the transcript that Judy Shelton brings forward.
Only is inflation a regressive tax, as David and Graham have been saying, and as I was saying, but the Biden tax claims that no one making less than $400,000 a year is going to be hit with any of the Biden taxes. The Tax Policy Center has just done a new study saying, no, there's going to be plenty of people who fall under that who are going to be paying higher taxes, hundreds of dollars of taxes, thousands of dollars of taxes, depending on their exact income. So another falsehood from government.
Yeah, I know.
By the way, in Judy's piece, she references the work of Jerry Jordan, who was the head of the Cleveland Fed during this time. And in reference to what you're saying, Graham, about these Fed officials chuckling about the situation, she has a quote from Jerry, and Jerry's an old friend, which I might even read.
Yeah, please.
He says, "I would expect the majority of the responses to be, why are you going to reduce it at all?" He's asking, right? "Explain to me why the dollar is not going to purchase the same at the end of the next century as it does today. The difference between 13 cents and 7 cents is the difference between a 2% rate of inflation and a 3% rate of inflation over 100 years. Mm. I think most people would view that as a silly alternative. They would say, why not zero inflation? And what they're talking about is what the average person would think about what the Fed officials are saying." Mm-hmm. And so the average person would say, why not zero inflation? Right.
Because now
Jordan is pretty famous. I have this recollection of years ago, him writing extensively in the Bulletin of the St. Louis Fed. Am I
No, that's correct? Very likely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's a fool's errand that these people are on when they're thinking they're going to get away with inflation with no serious consequences.
Speaking of economic consequences, I noted this interesting story that I didn't fully understand about the eviction moratorium, which I think was a California imposed policy, if I'm not mistaken. And now there's a...
Actually stems from the Center for Disease
Control. CDC, that's right.
You may have thought they were a medical body, but it turns out they make economic policy.
Wow.
So they put this on, and, you know, it's sort of coming to an end. So progressives and various people that think they, you know better than the market are in, they're throwing their hands up in the air at the prospect that some rent is going to be due. And, you know, the landlords have had to try to keep maintenance and pay their taxes and pay vendors and so forth, keep the buildings painted. And sometimes without receiving rent. And now they're going to say, well, we'd like our rent, please, because otherwise you're going to have to leave. And so some states have huge surpluses. California, where we are, is one of them. And so front page of the New York Times, using surplus, California hopes to forgive debt of renters. To forgive renters.
Which is to say they're going to pay the landlords out of the state surplus. Well, that good because at least it's compensating them for what was taken from them. Is that right?
They should never have taken it from them in the first place. And it's also just a bad incentive in general because the renters are going to say to themselves, well, next time there's any distress, mm-hmm. we should just get this moratorium again.
That's right.
And we, again, shouldn't have to come up with the money ourselves, come up to scratch. And not, oh, no, because the state will have that money.
The state allegedly has the money from these huge, essentially, bailout measures that
federal money. Some of it is that during
essentially expand the money supply.
They didn't have certain expenses that they would normally have. There's a variety of reasons, but they have a ton of money on hand.
Right. So, so you essentially mismanage all these locales, state, local, whatever, and the Fed then just prints money and then you bail them out. So there's no incentive not to mismanage it.
Right. And then from the point of view of the individual, you know, citizen or consumer or renter, it's very analogous to the situation with tuition. So, for example, you know, basically, if in fact President Biden has his way and others too, that you're going to have debt forgiveness for student loans and whatnot. So if, you know, those poor chumps who were trying to be prudent and decided, you know, to save money and not go to the expense of college and be careful what they borrow, they're going to be on the losing end of the stick, because all the ones who were imprudent and took big risks and got big in debt, those people are going to, you know, they're going to get off free. So it punishes the prudent and rewards the foolish.
Recipe.
And it's
so speaking of mismanagement and tons of money and COVID relief and supplemental funds, in K-12 education, there is a situation where all this money is flowing to the public school systems. Millions and millions of dollars that they wouldn't otherwise normally have. They had, you know, even though they were paying teachers who weren't necessarily teaching, a lot of expenses of K-12 schools really were way down during the, they're still getting property taxes, they're still getting their state tax revenues, they're still getting federal subsidies of various sorts. So they have a lot of money, plus they have huge supplemental monies from the states and from the federal government.
Great.
So in California, the law says, including the laws that provided these funds, these extra funds, that they have to have a plan that's public, and they have to have oversight plans, accountability plans, making sure that the money actually goes where they claim it's going to go. Do they have any of this in place? No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
You know, speaking about spending and inflation, we have one of our participants on the program with us today, I think through our thinkspot.com platform friends, who's forwarded me this, well, it's kind of an incendiary comment or question, but I think you guys could address it well. And maybe I'll toss it to David, but Mr. Thunder, I think I'll call him Mr. Thunder, says, were the massive COVID bailouts and issuing bonds done in part to give China further creditor leverage on the United States?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is we essentially have zero interest rates. So fund managers can borrow at zero interest, invest, and buy out all sorts of different things. China, which is heavily invested in the US, and different Chinese companies and so forth, most of the major companies in China have controlling interest from the Chinese military. So, you know, there's no surprise that the Biden administration is soft on these kinds of measures that really help China.
Here's another.
Though I will say, though, that in the European Union G7 meetings, the Biden administration has been very hostile to China, and you know, we have stories, a new Cold War with China and so forth. So it's a mixed bag. They're giving special favors to some companies and some interests, and they're also potentially throwing a bone to the military-industrial complex by hawkishly revving up tensions. So, you know, we have this careful, realistic examination that we're making of what goes on in American politics, but there's also a better side to American political tradition that all three of us try to bring out: the ideals of the American founding, the Jeffersonian ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, checks on government power. We talked about checks and balances during this session and so forth. And this is supposed, things like this are supposed to be taught to our children in school, how the American system works, But progressives are trying to take over civics education.
How so, Bill?
Well, so they have this, they have various things called, it has various names, public and, you know, engaged civics, action civics, culturally relevant civics. The basic idea is they're going to train children to become activist progressives, and even while they're in school, engaging in political efforts to make changes in government policy. And they have a new framework for this called Educating for American Democracy, and there's federal laws that are being proposed to put meat on the bones of this by pouring money in, and there are all sorts of beltway bandits and NGOs and foundations and so forth that have model curricula, some of which are even overtly admit that they're pro-socialism, that are waiting to collect this money. So it's a real problem, because the average member of the public and even the legislator, who should be informed at the state level, at the school board level, at the Congress level, they see civics and they think American flag, Pledge of Allegiance, singing the national anthem, learning how a bill becomes law. They don't think what this really is, just training people to become political activists for progressive causes. And that's what this initiative amounts to.
Remind us, where is this initiative coming from, specifically with these national civic standards that are kind of pernicious?
It's the usual suspects that are out there in the world of curriculum design and so forth. I just think it's a bit complex to try and explain, because there are, as I said, all these outlying people with fill in the details type lesson plans and so forth. But it's mostly being pushed by leftists and liberals, but there are a bunch of conservatives who feel this is a unifying thing, and it's not as bad as not having civics, which, you know, is not the truth. There is physics.
It's ironic. Being taught. It's ironic, though, because I have a number of conservative friends who are concerned about civics education in the United States. We've got to have more civics education, but then they don't think about who is going to be in charge of it and who will control the content. They think that somehow you can fix the public schools by demanding that the public schools give more attention to civics education, but when they do so, they may do it in this pernicious manner.
You have to remember, the struggle is never over. There's nothing wrong with demanding more knowledge of civics on the part of school children. The problem is that it's a never-ending battle, because there's a lot of people that want to use the public schools for their ends.
David?
I'd say that the good news, in part because of the COVID shutdown of schools and the difficulty that parents have had to adapt to that, plus the distance learning by Zoom, lots of parents have learned something about what Bill is talking about how the civics is being taught to their children. We're talking about K through 12, and they're not happy. This meeting I mentioned in Virginia, these parents, they're just absolutely outraged, and they're going to have a recall of the board. And so
public schools lost 1.3 million pupils last year. That's actually a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. So I think there is this grassroots movement led by mothers primarily, and it's going to have a huge, again, talking about the culture is being so crucial. And we're seeing this grassroots phenomenon coming up all over the place. Progressives are trying to deride it, claiming that it's astroturf or something. There's some secret conspiracy funded by the Kochs or you know, who knows, right? Which is just nonsense. And this is a legitimate movement. And again, it relates to the relevance of the book I showed initially by James Tooley. So Tooley gives parents the way out about how to create schools that are viable at low cost, that are high quality. And so I think that's the kind of message that a lot of these parents are looking for. But at least they're realizing that the schools, led by the teachers' unions and by these activists, are really a danger to the success of their own children and the success of the country.
We have talked about a lot of important things today. We covered the territory. Any further comments from either Bill or David by way of saying goodbye to our friends today?
Just, you know, I have to mention a topic I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal a month ago, which is critical race theory, identity politics, taking over math teaching in K-12. I mean, this was so egregious, so astounding, that people are still kind of reeling from the fact that a subject that's so cut and dried, so objective, so neutral in the face of politics is having an invasion of politics in it. And it's a pretty good example of what we're up to in our society right now, what's going on, and how people have to really push back.
This is why the, you know, talking about objectivity, this is why when the veil is pulled back on the curtain or whatever is pulled back on really what progressives are aiming at, the average person cannot believe it and will not put up with it. And so I think that, you know, we've mentioned a number of different issues that are triggering this. And so I think the trend is a very constructive one, that people are realizing that the values of a free society and the practical reality of bringing up families and work and the cost of living and all these other aspects of life are endangered by big government folly and cultural nonsense. And so I think that there's room to be optimistic about the trend, and we'll continue to work on it.
I think ordinary Americans, they're not on board with all this crazy stuff. And they realize that, you know, whether we build a wall at the border or not, in America, walls are never about keeping people in. For all of our faults as a country historically, we have created for the world examples of liberty and an aspiration to common justice and common sense, which really exceeds any other place. It's worth
of the 4th of July.
It is, which is right. Coming up, yeah.
Yeah, and just to put a cap on it, 2 + 2 does equal 4.
Really does.
It does.
Okay.
Decimal system, right?
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, David Thoreau. Thank you, Williamson Evers. Thank you for all of our friends coming to us via ThinkSpot, also YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. We'd love to have you with us, and we invite you to look forward to the next episode of The Independent Outlook from the Independent Institute. And be sure to head to our website. I invite you to do this every time, independent.org. We give you the resources to try and understand a lot of these complicated things that bear upon your life and liberty, independent.org. With that, good day to you all, and come back next time. Bye-bye.